As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody. This is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Thank you so much again for joining us. Rugby is getting more crazy and more nuts, not less crazy and less nuts. And just to try and get some shape and to pick the bones out of it, I have two excellent guests today. One is Mark Palmer, our Scottish, distinguished, I should say, Scottish rugby correspondent. And the other is the great Will Kelleher. And lads, I just want to ask you just to give us a taster which games you covered on the weekend. Mark, where were you?
Sat on my couch, actually, Steve. It's my young fellow's birthday this weekend, so I got a rare Saturday and Sunday off, would you believe?
Mark, Will, surely you were at a big game.
Well, no, you've done us like a kipper, both of us there, because I was having a break too. There's been too much news happening in the week, and the games we haven't been able to attend. But we're fully into it this week. 7 days, no break, Six Nations is here. We kind of need it, don't we?
We do, but it's funny you should say that, because I didn't go to a game either.
Oh, no.
I was...
Were you a breaking news
I was
about
in
Wales?
Breaking news in Wales, and I didn't go to a game. So it's a great panel today, because none of us saw any rugby on the weekend. But coming up on today's podcast, we'll be looking at the Six Nations and what a fantastic prospect it is. Probably because rugby's suffering here and there, this prospect of the Six Nations, glorious prospect, is just something that I think we all really need and the game really needs. First of all, though, we'll be going to or looking at the Calcutta Cup on Saturday at Twickenham in the company of Will and Mark, and also former Scottish captain John Barclay is going to join us. John, very, very enticing. Before we start, just ask you, when you played rugby, how would you have managed if you had not been able to tackle anyone above the waist?
Oh, God, straight into it. It would have changed the game, certainly.
Yeah.
Bizarrely, I was a low tackler, but
sure.
Yeah, I think, and I had to have, but you had to have the ability to tackle high, and that was kind of the fun of the game, was tackle selection, actually making choices, making the right tackle selection for the right ball carriers is part of the game. So yeah, it's a bit of a mess this week with all this stuff going on, isn't it?
It's terrible. John, we read you in the Times this morning on the game on Saturday. It strikes me is that it's huge for Scotland, in that with England being in some sort of disarray, obviously with Borthwick there, they won't be quite so bad, but they do have a few players out. Scotland almost favourites for it now.
I wouldn't go that far. Certainly wouldn't go that far. I guess history would suggest that they're anything but favourites going down there. But no, I think there's, it's like that whole pre-season thing, and I was chatting to Mark about it last week, you know, no one actually knows where they are until they've played a game. And that's what's, I guess, so impressive about the likes of Ireland and France. They seem to just pick up exactly where they left off. So we don't know what to expect. Scotland have got a reasonably settled side, albeit with some injuries and guys lacking a bit of game time, probably in key positions. So yeah, I look at the quality they've got throughout that team. You know, there's ways to pull a team together, and from everything I've heard and listened to about Steve Borthwick, he's the man that could definitely make that happen within a couple of weeks.
John, I was going to ask you about that 2018 game, and actually, when I was watching the Edinburgh Saris the other day, it seemed like there was a concerted effort from a couple of guys to rile up the likes of Billy Vanapola, Maritoji, and a few others. I know Billy's not playing, but was that something that you took in that 2018 game? I mean, there was that famous tunnel bust up with Ryan Wilson, wasn't there? But could you take us back a few years and tell us how you managed it that day?
I think you take it a year further back, 2017, and I think we were probably as poor as we were from a sort of performance point of view. I think there was a lot of let's just put it, a little bit of disappointment in terms of the way that some of the England players probably carried themselves that day in the game and beyond. So
it was the one where that was the 60-21 one, that one.
Yeah, so there was just a bit of, I think the pain was always going to be there from the game itself, but I remember we were probably still smarting a little bit from the game, but also from, I guess, some of the behaviour or work stuff that was said. So that's the great thing about the Six Nations, so you hope you get another chance out of it. So we got another chance out, you know, playing England, you never get a chance to obviously play that game again, but I think we probably erred on the emotional side that game, and it's like derbies we always talk about. Do you really focus on the emotion, or do you focus on the technical, tactical side of it? And often it's a blend of the two, but it was chance of worry best. A few weeks ago, and it's interesting just to hear that they kind of did the same stuff. Like in Ireland, they tried to focus as much as they can on the technical, tactical stuff early in the week, so that when you get to, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you can really lean on that emotional side of the game, which is still really important. So I think we probably got the balance just right that week. Ryan probably pushed it a bit in the tunnel.
Literally pushed it.
Right. Well, I think he didn't push anyone, I don't think.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
We got it right that week, and there was a build-up to it, and it just felt, I don't know, it was one of those games that, you know, from kickoff, you kind of felt like we weren't going to lose.
Yeah.
John, and I'll ask Mark Palmer this as well, the same question. It's slightly baffling from this range when you look at Finn Russell and Gregor Townsend, and both fantastic players, both actually fantastic attacking players, but seem to have lost the wavelength, and they sort of get the wavelength, then they seem to lose it again. As far as we know, and this is obviously important for the team, are they back on the wavelength now 100%? Because if they are, it does change the stakes a bit.
It seems to be. I do think we focus a lot, probably too much, on that relationship rather than just the performance side of it. And they've probably given us good reason to be fair, in the last couple of years. So it seems like, yeah, I think I just look back at the Autumn Series and the Orm Series, you know, albeit as a very different proposition to Six Nations. But I think the quality that Pippen came in with in those last two games showed that he was back where he needs to be. I don't think he'd probably been playing his best rugby with Racing for a little while. So, but he looks like he's enjoying himself again. I mean, Gregor seemed to be on a wavelength where they can, I guess, get on with things. So, yeah, I mean, regardless, Finn's going to be the most important player in that team. So as best as they can manage that relationship, I think it's going to be great to make sure he gets the most out of himself and those around him.
And Mark, you're close to Finn. But how do you read it? Is he on form and in the right frame of mind?
I think so, and I think following on what John said there, I think they're probably in as good a place as they're ever going to be. I think it's one of those relationships where if they can find a way to work together, it's never going to be a bed of roses, but as long as they're kind of vaguely on the same page, then I think everyone benefits. And although it goes against every kind of grain of Gregor's coaching philosophy, I think he's realised that he can, you know, there's something to be gained from chucking the keys to Finn to a certain extent in terms of managing the attack and not trying to be too controlling about that. And I think that's something, that sort of space is where Finn produces his best work, his most mad work as well. But I think, you know, if he feels he's been listened to and being given the responsibility to shape things, then that's when I think he produces his best for the group.
And John, just on roughly on this, in the same department, everyone's looking for what you might call a Manu Tuilagi. England are looking for Manu or anyone, but because Manu's not on great form. But Tupilotu, in the games I've seen the two teams play, and also just the sort of player he is. Is he a kind of missing link who's come into the Scottish team now with that power?
I think the centres has chopped and changed more than any position. And I think Alistair Power has some stat about, you know, I think maybe like 24 different partnerships with 18 different players, something crazy over Gregor's time in Scotland. So it's kind of been a position or a pair of positions where we didn't really know who was going to play. I think we always knew Chris Harris was going to play at the moment, or we assumed he's going to play, but who plays inside him? We went from, you know, Cam Redpath was going to be the next big thing, and then he obviously got injured after one test, which was pretty brutal. Sam Johnson's been there. It's chopped change, but I think to answer your question, I think I've watched Tupilotu this year almost every week. He's taken his game to another level. He seems to be taking the responsibility on as a key playmaker. And I mean, you watch Glasgow playing, he's the man who is almost running the whole attack, it seems. You know, looking from an outsider's point of view. So he's that kind of Bundyaki, Manu kind of role. Hunter Paisami, you know, that kind of role, where, you know, incredibly explosive, can be incredibly powerful of their right, but also has a good skill set, which Scotland, I think, can, it'd be a nice sort of foil to sit to Finn, to know that he can drop the ball off to him or Chris Harris, but he's also got something creative there. So there's not many players that can do both.
John, I'd love to get your thoughts on, you mentioned consistency of selection there, but I was going to widen it out and talk about consistency of results. I was just going back through Gregor's Six Nations, and it's fascinating to see the sort of lack of ability to back up big wins, perhaps. So, like, for example, 2017, beat Ireland, lost to France, beat Wales, lost to England. Then more recently, 2021, beat England, lost to Wales, beat France, lost to Ireland. 2022, beat England, lost to Wales. So is it more in the Six Nations trying to put wins together, almost the targeting the first two rather than just the first one, perhaps?
Yeah, I think part of it is that the competition is so hard now, so you're not getting beaten by, you know, mugs, so it's worth considering that. I look at last year, it was a massive opportunity miss, you know, down in Wales. I think Wales were there for the taking that day, and there's been some performances, you know, the Murrayfield game the year before, they beat England, and then the following week they had Wales at home again, and I guess the circumstances were a bit unusual. The Xander Pedersen got sent off with 35 minutes to play, so you kind of felt like the writing was, he was always going to be against them, but I think there's enough guys in there who are very aware of that ability to have one big game. But I guess if you look back, we were always notorious slow starters. You know, we'd get beat in the first game and then we'd bounce back. So, like, I think if you could put together a couple of wins, especially this year, given the quality we think we're going to see, I think you guys put yourself in a pretty good spot. So whether that's, you know, game one, two, three, but you're going to have to put a few together, because I think the pack, you know, below Ireland, France, is all going to be scrapping out for that third position.
John, you guys were talking in the Times about second row. Basically, Grant Gilchrist highly rated up there, possibly not so much in other parts of the game, but certainly up in Scotland. And Richie Gray is being tipped by you guys as probably one of the sort of late career, he's really going to blossom. I mean, that looks a likely sort of pairing to me, and to you.
Yeah, that's true. That's who I would pick, I think, definitely. I think Gilchrist is going to play. And Richie, for whatever reason, I don't think necessarily your careers can be sort of a linear path. Certainly mine wasn't. So give him an opportunity to come back in and start. He's been brilliant for Glasgow when I've watched him play. He's not as physical as other second rows, but I guess what he lacks in, you know, that physicality compared to others, he makes up for in athletic ability, line-out ability, scrummaging, mauling, all that sort of stuff. The stuff that he learned probably in a career in France.
I was going to ask as well, I mean, we spoke to Gregor Townsend on our pod last week, and he's been coy about his future, isn't he? Not sure whether he'll get a contract after this. If this is to be his last Six Nations, John, which it might be, what do you think Scotland will leave? He will leave Scotland with that kind of legacy thing, good, bad, or otherwise. What do you think he'll leave behind if he does move on after this year?
I mean, it's like a player, isn't it? You hope that if and when you leave, it's a bit of a cheesy cliche that you leave the team and the jersey in a better position, but I think as a coach you have the same hope. So, and I guess off the back of that, you just have to ask, you know, has Gregor left them in a better position? And I think for me it would be a resounding yes. I think you look at the quality of players he's brought through, the dynamic of the group, the work he's done. I think particularly after 2019 and how disappointing that was, and the ability he had as a coach to evolve as a coach and evolve his strategy. So it's one of those things that, you know, I always joke about it. I would hate to be a coach, because you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And at some point, you're going to get sacked. And that's the reality. Or you're going to be asked to move on, you're not going to get a contract. You know, not many people, I guess, get the farewell that Vern Cotter got. And people, you know, there's an assumption there that Vern would have gone on to, you know, make Scotland this formidable force. But the reality is probably that the same situation would have happened. You know, Scotland would have lost a bit of form, as has happened with, you know, Wales and England with Eddie Jones. And that's what happened. So Vern did a lot of good work. And for me, I do think that Gregor continued that work. It's been frustrating, I think, probably is that it hasn't resulted in anything more serious in terms of contention for the Six Nations. But I also think there has to be a pinch of realism to it. You know, look at the quality of the teams you're playing every week, and then you look at the resources and the numbers that Scotland have. So it's probably unfair to judge, I think, a Scotland coach against an Ireland or a France or an England. And actually, for that, I think everything Greg has done should be lauded, to be honest.
Are they going to do it on Saturday?
I mean, yeah. I was going to say, it should be easy, but I don't know.
Rarely lose a Kolkata Cup these days.
Well, it's quite unusual, isn't it, that for years and years Scotland couldn't get their hands on it, and then They've had it for four of the last 5 years, so there'll be confidence going into the group. I think I really do believe that that group of Wales, England, and Scotland, I think they'll beat each other. And if one went against France, that'll be the difference. So I think the Scottish boys could win this weekend. I think it will be incredibly tight, and we don't know what to expect from England. But I guess I'm avoiding the question. If I had to say yes or no, I'd say yes. Scotland will win this weekend.
Ah, well spoken, well said, John. John, thanks a million for joining us, and we look forward to catching up with you as the tournament goes. And wishing you a great Six Nations as well.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that was John Barclay, and well worth while. He's always good words. Mark, in terms of the general situation in Scotland, I think I've had this conversation with you many times. You always feel they're always on the verge of a run and putting them where they once were, and that is just one of the most difficult teams to beat in world rugby, really. Do you get the sense that if they do win, then there's a great chance of finally starting to kind of fulfil their aspirations and getting the nation back on side?
Possibly, although actually I would say that this is the first year in many where there really is no sense of anybody saying, oh, this could be our year, that this is when it's really going to turn. I think even the most ardent and optimistic fans have got to the point where sort of being on the cusp is the default position. Following on from our chat there with John, that's probably the biggest frustration of this whole Gregor Townsend era, is that, you know, yes, there's been seasons of three wins, which is generally perceived to be a good campaign, but it's never taken them to a point where going into the final weekend of a Six Nations, they're actually genuinely in contention. And so they've taken a lot of steps forward, but not that kind of very last one from being a good side to one that is genuinely challenging for honours. And I think, yes, it could happen this year, but that whole point about how this is potentially a two-speed tournament, or a league within a league, where with France and Ireland and then the rest, you know, even winning the three home games against Wales, Ireland and Italy, which in itself is going to be a hard ask, that could well not be enough to have you contending. So I think, you know, the best case scenario is probably that they are muddling along in that, still on the cusp by the end of this tournament, I have to say.
The two pro clubs, Edinburgh and Glasgow, they seem to me to be reached a point where, unlike previous seasons, they are devilishly difficult to beat on their day at home and even once or twice away. Are they still in an upward curve, however sort of slowly?
I think so, and certainly at Glasgow they've had a massive uplift this year with the advent of Franco Smith. You know, we all know that Glasgow had had a, you know, under Sean Lennie, and then Gregor himself had gone on that great journey that ended in them winning the Pro 12 title, as it then was, in 2015. They then had a bit of a dip, albeit, you know, with the odd success of getting to another final under Dave Rennie, but there wasn't that same feeling of them kind of, you know, persistently on the way up and, you know, developing their own talent and, you know, great Scottish players coming through, of the likes of, you know, Finn Russell, Stuart Hogg and Johnny Gray, who'd all been and gone by that point. But since Franco came in the summer, they've rediscovered a bit of an edge to their game as well, while still maintaining that kind of typical Glasgow DNA of looking to move the ball from pretty much anywhere. The Edinburgh built some very solid foundations under Richard Cockerell, and then I think that had naturally run its course once people stopped listening to being shouted at every day of the week.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, indeed. Mike Blair came in last summer with a much more kind of touchy-feely style of management, shall we say, and a lot more ambitious game plan. Had some great early successes there, albeit they fell away in the second half of the season. This time round, it's been a more difficult second album for them, but again, recent weeks, especially with that Saracens win, they've shown an ability to sort of win in more than one way, which has been the big challenge for both of them over the years. So I think, yeah, there is a genuine sense of both being kind of on an upwards trajectory, maybe Glasgow a more advanced stage of that journey than Edinburgh.
It's a fascinating matchup this weekend, isn't it? And I'm thinking, with as someone who writes more about England than I do Scotland, it's a weird flip this year, I think, because there's far more known about Scotland and who are going to play for Scotland and what they're going to play like than there is England, with the obvious change of Borthwick coming in and new coaches, Sinfield, Nick Evans. There's going to be at least one debutant, I think. Probably Hassel Collins will get a game, and Jack Walker, depending on how fit Jamie George is, will either start or come off the bench, I'd imagine. But you mentioned their touchy-feely, Mark. It's a funny one, because you wouldn't really imagine maybe that Steve Borthwick's the most touchy-feely head coach ever, but every performance he's given so far to us, Steve, in the press, has been sensational, hasn't it? He's talked an amazing game, and now he needs to play one.
And actually totally against what the perception we had of the guy was, definitely.
Yeah. But that's going to be the fascinating narrative for Saturday, is how do England play? Who plays for them? And I think the only thing that Borthwick needs is a win, and that's it. 3-0, 9-6, anything. Because then they move on to Italy, which they've never lost to Italy, and they would be absolutely stunned if they were to lose to them. And then you're into it, and it's a bye week, more time with the players. Wales away is a very tough game. But it's a funny one, Mark, isn't it? Because I think Gregor Townsend was talking about this at the launch event the other week, that there's kind of no footage to go on for England because they don't really know what's coming. And do they study Leicester? And then Borthwick was asked about that, and he said, well, if they want to do that, fill your boots because we're going to play differently to Leicester. So there's so much wrapped into this Saturday, isn't there, Mark?
There is another big one for me, and maybe one we should have asked John in hindsight, is around the, you know, when Scotland finally broke their Twickenham hoodie there last time out and won for the first time in 38 years, it was, of course, in the COVID era.
Yeah, no fans, yeah.
This time, there's a full house, but I was going to ask him around, you know, is there a difference between, 80,000-90,000 English people being against you than 80,000 French or Irish, for example, or Welsh? I mean, is it a different kind of hostility that you get at Twickenham? It
probably sounds more like the House of Commons.
Does it feel like that at pitch level as well? It doesn't seem to have quite this bite. I don't know, but...
When the pretty last time England were out, there was an incredible lot of hostility, all of it directed at the England team.
Their own team.
Yeah, by the crowd. I mean, you must sense, Mark, you're speaking a lot on the record, as it were, for your job, or off the record with mates and international players. Surely they must sense deep down that this is a great chance.
Oh, absolutely. And I think they have taken huge confidence, whether it was in front of a crowd or not. You know, they did win the game there last time, you know, had the astonishing comeback and then chuck away job in the previous game in 2019, that mad draw. So, you know, the last couple of times have gone relatively well. We just, as John said, we don't mention 2017 and who was captain that day. So, but the last couple, you know, there's knowledge in the bank for a large number of this group that they can and have done it. That was against, you know, in theory, a much more settled and developed England team than the one they're going to be facing this weekend. The concern would be, do England revert to type, you know, go after Scotland up front? And I know Steve's going to be, as you say, not, you know, Steve Borthwick talking about not necessarily following the same template as the Tigers, but, you know, is he just going to revert to fundamental set-piece defence, put the ball in the air?
Quite like that.
Yeah. And that's a game that has, you know, the Scotland have struggled with traditionally. They have been this group that, you know, they have been able to be got at by sides who play that kind of rugby. So if that's what transpires, then again they're going to have to show that they can cope with it, which hasn't always been the case.
Well, I'm just going to ask you in a second, who will England be playing, and how would you resolve the debatable positions? Before you do, just getting the sort of anxious about Courtney Laws, who's a fantastic player, wonderful bloke, by all accounts a wonderful leader, and has matured from being a sort of almost sort of psycho reserve flanker when he first came into a great player. But Courtney has a long period off with a concussion.
Yeah.
When he comes back, he gets an injury. When he comes back, he gets another. Is he? It's kind of precarious with Courtney at the moment. I mean, we don't know. He may come booming out and play in the next game, etc. But you are worried about him. Where else are England? Have England got problems or selectorial dilemmas?
Yeah, well, Steve Borthwick a couple of weeks ago picked 36 players, and he's ended up having to pick five more because there's been injuries and ins and outs. So yeah, Laws was one, and he's not in the squad this week and won't be playing. England confirmed that on Sunday night, and actually this time it's a calf injury, so thankfully not another head or neck or anything to do with his brain. But he's had a hell of a run, hasn't he? And Phil Dowson, his coach at Northampton Saints, was saying the other day that this recent calf injury he got against Munster a few weeks ago, he just saw him lying on the physio table just going, God, I thought bad luck came in threes, not fours and fives. So he's the unlucky one. Dave Ribbons has come into the squad, possibly to fill the sort of extra players rather than actually come into the team, maybe. Then the hooker thing is really interesting because Jamie George is still in camp and going through the return to play protocols, but he can only pass them absolutely by Thursday, which is the day that England are going to pick the team, as will Scotland. So Borthwick's going to kind of either have to pick him in the side, not absolutely certain that he's 100% through those protocols, or leave him out completely, which then leaves Jack Walker, who's not being capped, and Tom Dunn, who's got three caps, because George McGuigan's another guy who's out with a knee injury. The other one was confirmed on the weekend that Elliot Daly's now out for the whole Six Nations, so he's got a hamstring injury, and that was compounded by Henry Slade, who's missing this week with a hip problem. So the midfield is now becoming slightly more simple. It's probably Farrell at 10, Tuilagi, and maybe Marchand or Kelly, depending on how dynamic or otherwise you want to be with that. So yeah, I think it's the midfield may be fairly simple by the end of it, because it's who's left, with a couple of new guys on the wings that I mentioned before, Hassel Collins, Caden Murley could come into the mix there. Max Malins has had some caps but been out of it, but two of those are going to have to play. But then there's this the new old figure. Do you remember Anthony Watson, Steve?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
He's back in the squad. Played for Leicester on the weekend, has just come back from another injury, a foot problem. And hadn't been in the original squad, but he could come straight back into it as someone who's got 50 caps. So lots of selection dilemmas. We'll have more clarity later in the week.
We had some clarity from our colleague Stuart Barnes, my school contemporary, this morning in the paper. And I disagreed with everything he said about the midfield.
That's rare, isn't it?
And then it is. Owen Farrell, Manu Tuilagi, definitely. The first two are right on the sheet. And also, I just feel really sad for Henry Slade, clearly. But I would have absolutely loved to see Elliot Daly at outside centre there. He's the best natural footballer and most incisive runner that they have. Anthony Watson is a bit like we were talking about Richie Gray earlier, someone who probably has not quite fulfilled himself but still has a chance to. And I just think Anthony Watson is a fabulous player, especially when he looks to get involved, as he did on the weekend with the Tigers. So it's you feel a little bit sorry for Borthwick with losing players, but everyone loses players at the moment, so it's just one of those things.
As a little guesstimation, here we go, to tuck myself up massively when this isn't the team, but I just thinking off the top of my head, I reckon the team would be something along the lines of Genge, Jamie George, if fit, Jack Walker, if not, Sinclair, with Cole maybe on the bench, although maybe later in the tournament that could swap round if Sinclair's a better impact man. Itoje and Johnny Hill likely to stay. Then I think they've got options whether they go for like a double jackal, Jack Willis and Ben Curry, or a big six in Nick Azikra. I believe that's what they were training with last week, with Don Brandt as possibly the favourite as the number eight ahead of Simmons. And then it's JVP, probably likely to start ahead of Ben Youngs. They could easily swap round. As we said then, Farrell, Tuilagi, I would say maybe Marchand, just because Kelly's not been capped and perhaps him and Tuilagi together is a bit similar. And then they love Hassel Collins, it seems, so he'd be on one wing. Stewart at fullback. And then really unsure about the possible right wing. Murley, Malins, Watson, a couple of nice options there. But I think that's largely where it's looking. So we'll see how that goes.
There we are, Mark. You and I know what the England team is now. It's just been announced. Mark, who do the Scots, above anyone else, fear amongst the people they're likely to come up against? Or who do you think, from your experiences, is the danger man in the England team?
Hard to say. I think collectively that pack is probably what it boils down to, and what we know, or what we suspect, I suppose, is a better way of putting it, that they are capable of. I think Scotland have managed to get away in the last couple of editions of the fixture from that kind of stereotype of always being beaten up front by England, but there's still that lurking away in the background of all our imaginations as to being a distinct possibility. So I think more than one individual player, it's the collective size and ability of that pack which would concern me.
Another game on, a minor confrontation in Cardiff between Wales and Ireland. There have been a lot of confrontations in Cardiff and Wales over the last few months, mostly into internecine warfare. I was there last week for a long period and I couldn't believe the bile that's circulating there. And it came across to me at some stages like this enclave of the Welsh Rugby Union inside there with the wagons circled all around, not wanting to come out and not wanting really to help everybody else out there in the wider world. I found it poisonous. And the departure of Steve Phillips, the chief executive, which absolutely had to happen, there was no way. After the pervasive atmospheres of sexism, horrible racism and misogyny down there, he could possibly stay. But if anyone thinks the problems are all over now because he's gone, well, that's wrong as well. Welsh Rugby Union, especially the board, are basically a bunch of old blokes in blazers who are not contributing. Warren Gatland is contributing, and so are the team. And as I said this before, I don't think they'll beat Ireland at Cardiff on Saturday, although I think it'll be a lot closer than people think. But by the end of the season, I think they'll have assimilated other players and be reasonably competitive. Ireland, we come to you first, Mark. Your favourites for the title, as they are at home to France? Then we'll ask Will the same question.
I think, just to mix it up, in our official predictions yesterday, Steve, I'd gone for France to lose this weekend in Dublin, but then to win the championship. Sorry, to lose in Dublin when they go there, but to win the championship. So that'll rely on somebody else knocking over Ireland at some point, of course.
Yeah, Will?
Yeah, I've got a sneaky feeling. I think Ireland are the favourites of the bookies. I was looking this morning, and number one in the world and all that, and the only game they lost last year was to, once to All Blacks and then the other one to France away, so pretty decent season. But it's just this endless thing with Ireland is backing it up, isn't it? Not peaking too early and all that. If they were to do it, it would be a fantastic achievement and deserve. They've got a hell of a good team, but I do feel like someone is going to beat them, yeah. And I wouldn't put it past Gatland. He absolutely loves beating Ireland, doesn't he? Having been unceremoniously binned in the 90s there.
Well, Johnny Sexton, not quite the equivalent of Courtney Laws in that he's always injured, but there does seem to be an ephemeral look about him. So often, even if he stays on the field, he's down having treatment. Mm. He's now 103 years old. Does so much depend on him being fit?
Yeah, absolutely. Completely. And has done for this World Cup cycle, the last one, and probably the one before that as well. It's incredible, isn't it? 37, to be that integral to the team. I mean, Alan Wynne-Jones has been for Wales in a similar way, but isn't as influential to the whole game plan and everything else that Sexton is. But yeah, I think that's why it's so hard to predict these tournaments, isn't it? Because over the 7 weeks, so many different things will change, red cards, injuries and all that. But actually, in some ways, I know we, both of us, Mark, and we write about England a lot, and Mark writes about Scotland brilliantly, loads. But there's cause to say, I think, that Wales-Ireland could be the game of the weekend, actually, with all that's hanging on it, Gatland's return, Ireland number one, Farrell, all that sort of stuff. It could be a belter there, couldn't it? And I hope there's a good crowd.
Yeah, I think that actually behind closed doors at Hensel, Wales have been getting their mojo back. They were awful last time out. Also, Jack Morgan is a considerable contender on the flank. I think Taulupe Faletau has found form. A lot of question marks. I'd love to see George North at outside centre, but I'd love to see him get involved in the game like Anthony Watson. He's far too good to wait for the ball to come to him. But I just think that'll be a tremendous game. Mark, as a man who's much more fluent in Italian, I was going to say than you are in English, but I didn't mean that. Very fluent in Italian and a huge, a great commentator on the Italian scene. The confidence they get from Capuozzo, this marvellous lad, is that reflected in the team improving around him?
I think it is. He's almost been this jewel that's come out of nowhere for them, and obviously extremely important already, as we saw both at the fag end of the last Six Nations and the autumn. But, you know, there was a project put in place by the aforementioned Franco Smith, actually, when he was head coach, in terms of bringing through young guys very early into the team, probably some of them before they were ready. But they have now sort of accumulated a couple of years' worth of experience, some heavy defeats along the way, but the really starting to grow as a unit. And then, you know, I know they're always talking about performance, but the fact that they got a win in Wales, then against Australia, those are absolutely massive, because they've now got some tangible evidence that, yes, the performances are coming together, but they can actually win these games. So, you know, from Fischetti in the front row that you guys have been watching in the Premiership, to the Cannone brothers elsewhere in the pack, Garbisi brothers at halfback, although Stephen Varney also going well there, they've actually got, you know, a spine of a very good young team now. So, you know, whether that translates into one win, no wins, two wins this year, I think you'll see them take another step forward.
That'll be absolutely wonderful, because it just seems so lopsided. France, lads, we'll just have a final word on them. We used to say you never know with France, but that's sort of gone out the window a bit, Will. Their performance is consistent. Savage blow that Cameron Wockey is not there. And savage blow that Jonathan Dante's not there. I have to say, arguably, their best forward and their best back. But as far as you're concerned, still very dangerous.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But again, a bit like the Islanders thing, backing it up. They, for the first time in 12 years, won the title last year, and it's backing it up. And they've had a couple of little setbacks, as you mentioned. I mean, they're unbelievably sure, surely, to win against Italy away on the first weekend, but then it's an absolute belter away in Dublin. And if they were to win that, then you think, right, well, the same old France as last year. But if they were to lose that, it's like, you think, okay, there is a crack there. I just think with this year, particularly with them finishing it with a home World Cup, just start to see the pressure crank and crank and crank, and the expectation, and everyone's loving French rugby and everything's on Dupont's shoulders and all that. It'd just be interesting to see if they've still got that sort of steely determination that they grew last year and have done with Gaultier, Edwards, Ibanez and all that, because, yeah, if they keep growing and growing and think they'll lose, leave everyone else behind.
Yeah, just one thing I should say, my notes in front of me here, that it is absolutely crucial that Warren Gatland fixes the Welsh scrum, which is embarrassed in the autumn. Okay, lads, it's time to put ourselves on the block. We didn't see any games last weekend, but we have seen a few in our time. I'm going to ask second Will, first Mark, you're under pressure. We'd like to know the name of the Six Nations champions, please. Actually, I'm being a coward here. I'm going to go first because
lead us off.
I'm going to lead off because otherwise it's like I'm cowering in the background,
like some of these administrators around the game.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, if I could find them to see if they were cowering or not, would be great. The Six Nations champions this year will be Ireland, but no Grand Slam.
Who's next? Come on.
We now go to up north to Mark.
France also no Grand Slam.
Oh.
Will.
Yeah, Ireland no slam.
Okay, so that's... Is that two for Ireland?
Two for Ireland, one for France.
Maths is always my strong point, out of three. Two for Ireland, one for France, and let's be fair. Are we looking forward to it or not? Because I am so looking forward to the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's my 97th Six Nations, but I'm looking forward to it unbelievably.
We said at the top of the show, I think it feels like this season, if we count from the start of September, it's just lurched from one crisis to the next, particularly in English rugby. But Bernard Laporte in France with all the controversies and tax fraud allegations and all that over there. You've got the situation in Wales with the horrendous stuff that you've talked about, Steve. And we'll move on in a second to the farce of this tackle height directive in the RFU. But it's a season where we've lost two premiership clubs and had all sorts else go on. Mm. So the great Jamboree comes back and we all love it, don't we? And I think you've written... In years gone by, it's one of those things where you stumble into it in winter and before you know it, it's spring and it's everything's right in the world and everything. So we just need it to lift the spirits, I think, because it's been a hell of a average season off the field, hasn't it?
Absolutely. You mentioned the premiership there. Well, we should also say, it's apart from the two clubs going to the wall, it's been absolutely brilliant. Mark, you looking forward to it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And none more so than the chance to see your bonny faces at Twickenham on Saturday.
It'll be brilliant. That's Six Nations. We're going to come on in a minute to the fuss about tackles, tackle height. Then we'll be choosing our God and Goddess of the Week.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Will the tackle height controversy please pick the bones up for us? Because some people have got, including myself, got no idea what's happening.
Right. Well, yes, we touched upon it, and Alex Lowe was passionate about it last week when we were doing our Six Nations launch podcast, and it's moved on a leap. But if we roll it back to a couple of Thursdays ago, so they announced that all amateur players from National 1 below, men's game, Championship 1 and below, and the women's will be required to tackle from below the waist. Okay, then that kicked off a few days of furious reaction, including people like Ben Stokes, the England Test cricket captain, got involved, Ireland's Johnny Sexton, Andy Farrell said it was a rubbish idea. They were under increasing pressure then by last Tuesday to review it, and lots of clubs around the country were starting to mobilise, and pressure groups were set up. Community Clubs Union, or a Twitter account was created that are gathering together people to put a no-confidence vote in against Bill Sweeney, the RFU executive. There were lots of RFU council members told to rescind their vote and asked to resign. Then last Wednesday, the RFU backed themselves again and said, look, no, we are pushing forward this. We think it will make a game that's more entertaining to watch, was one of the many things that they talked about, as well as the science. And then we learned on Thursday night that there was a sort of panic council meeting where the RFU essentially apologised for its lack of communication to everyone in the game, because it emerged that what had happened the previous week was that the vote had been about lowering the tackle height, but nothing was mentioned about the word waist. And then, shock horror, a few days later on the Thursday when the press release came out, all this stuff about waist was there. So the RFU council members were furious, and we heard about them and wrote about it on Friday and in Saturday's Times. And now there's going to be a big period of consultation and a sort of redefining of what the lower tackle height should be, with talks across the game. So it's been an utter shambles from start to finish, and an incredible lack of foresight or communication. I mean, to take readers behind the curtain slightly, and I think we mentioned this on our podcast last week, this was one of the most fundamental changes that rugby union has made in its history. And to start with, it was announced by sharing a WhatsApp note around. There's a statement coming in 10 minutes. Here you go. This is it. With no press conference organised, no detail as to how they've come to the decision, no published or peer-reviewed science that went with it either. We had to push for an off-record briefing with people at the RFU to understand what was going on. So it's just been an utter, utter shambles, and it's not going to end. There's going to be far more to come with it, and far more news in the paper as we get it, I suppose, is the way to leave that off.
So it's basically waste, W-A-S-T-E, rather than W-A-I-S-T.
Yes.
Mark Palmer, we need to know the identity of your god or goddess of the week, please.
I'm going to go back to the aforementioned Ange Capuozzo for his sensational finish in the corner.
Oh, unbelievable.
Against Montpellier for Toulouse. Perfect segue into the Six Nations for that young man, I think.
I was off over the weekend, and so was Alex Lowe, who's elsewhere today, gathering news and breaking stories. But he sent me a couple of Twitter clips on my news. Have you seen this? And there's two angles of it. And please, if you can find it, anyone, go on Twitter if you're on it, and just Google Ange Capuozzo's try. It's unbelievable. He jumps over, fully over Kobus Hronach, and puts the one down in the right hand. Unbelievable scenes.
So is he your god?
No, I'm going devil for the aforementioned shambles at the RFU. And it's just one of those where you just think, how on earth did they think this was going to go well, putting it out in the way they did? So the sort of the faceless people.
I'm sorry. No, we need a name.
I don't know the name of the people who put the press release together and all that, but I think the RFU's communications on this has been desperate, and they probably deserve the devil of certainly last week and the week before that.
So the communications department, would you say the devil?
Yeah, I mean, it's not all of them, and it's some of it's directed from above and all that, and I know that they've got a job to do that they're told to do, but yeah, I think that was a major oversight to do it in the way they did, and they are now apologising for it and trying to backtrack.
Okay, so we should get mega and personal apology from Beelzebub, whoever she or he may be. And mine is Charlotte Wathan, who'd been verbally and abused in the Welsh Rugby Union. She'd been told that by someone that he would like to tie her up and basically molest her, and that was despicable. Charlotte had the guts to come out on TV and, despite her fears and despite her tears, explain the whole culture of the Welsh Rugby Union, and it led and has already led to change, and let's hope that it becomes a governing body worthy of the name in one of the most fanatical rugby countries, because at the moment the Welsh Rugby Union still is an absolute disaster. But the very last word goes to Will.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, we've talked a few times on this podcast about the Rugby Writers Club and the Pat Marshall Awards, which goes to the Rugby Personality of the Year, and members vote for it. And last year, I delivered the trophy to Monsieur Dupont in the hospitality suite of Toulouse, which was fine, a fine trip for me. But this time it went to Sarah Hunter, the outstanding Red Rose number 8, record caps breaker and all that. And our friends saw her at Worcester game. She was playing Loughborough Lightning. And yeah, Nick Heath, who's appeared on this podcast before, presented a surprise with Emily Scarrett with the trophy. So I thought, honourable mention to Sarah, who was a fine recipient of that award. So that all the way back to Mervyn Davis and everyone else. So she's now got her name forever etched on that trophy. Third female player to ever win it. So good on her.
Great call, Will. Many congratulations to Sarah Hunter. Worthy recipient. To everyone listening, have a fantastic Six Nations yourselves. We'll be back next week.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.